We'd wake up late, hang out on the water all afternoon, party all night, and then stumble home to sleep off the hangover. Before I met Swiss, I thought I knew how to truly enjoy myself. I definitely didn't. He was constantly introducing me to new places, new friends, new ways of seeing the world. With him, everything was about dreaming up these vivid, colorful ideas and then charging ahead on an adventure without a blueprint or worry. In many ways, he taught me how to live, how to throw out the rule book and make my own rules, how to jet over to the French Riviera last minute for some fun. On the weekend when we arrived in Saint-Tropez, Desi and Katya, this cute Bulgarian couple we rolled with a lot, hosted us in their home. When I got up around 11, Swiss hadn't returned. Desi had gone with him, Katya told me, so the two of us lounged by the pool and had some breakfast. "When will you be back?" I texted Swiss. We were planning a boat ride for that afternoon. "Almost done," he wrote. "You and Katya can just meet us at the marina at 3. Swiss and Desi were already on board the boat when we arrived. "Wow, I love it," I said as Katya and I settled into a couple of chairs on the front deck. That's when I noticed a funny look on Swiss's face. "What's up?" I said. "You okay?" "I'm fine," he assured me. Moments later, our boat left the dock. After an hour out on the water, we pulled into a cove surrounded by mountains. The sun lent the sea its rays, highlighting flecks of brilliant turquoise blue. "I gotta get in," I announced. If I weren't an artist, I'd be a mermaid. That's how much I love the water. I jumped right in from the edge of the boat and then stayed out there for a long time, alternating between swimming and floating around on my back, soaking in the beauty around me. Once it got chilly, I climbed back on board. The others weren't around. I figured they were hanging out indoors, so I dried off, took up the spot back in my chair, and vibed to the Bob Sinclair album that was playing. Swiss always brings along his own symphony. Swiss walked out on deck. "Come on," he said, playfully pulling me up from my seat and leading me to a rail near the bow. "Let's look at this beautiful sunset." We stood there in an embrace as the setting sun gave the water a pinkish blue tint. We reminisced about the specialness of our connection and how nothing has ever felt more electric or natural. And then suddenly, Swiss knelt down as if he dropped something. "What's happening?" I said, getting down on my knees beside him. "Stand up, girl," he said, laughing. I stared at him for a second, still clueless about what was unfolding. "No, seriously," he said. "Stand up." I rose. "Will you be my wife?" he asked. He opened a little black velvet box, revealing a silver band with a glistening diamond heart. "What?" I squealed. "Will you marry me?" he asked again. The tears came flooding down my face. "Yes," I said. I dropped down beside him again as he slid the ring onto my finger. I hugged him hard as the tears kept flowing, Desi and Katya snapping photos from behind us. "This is crazy," I kept saying. "Are we crazy?" "Yes, we're crazy." Moments later, our friends met us on the deck, eager to share the backstory of how the spontaneous proposal had come together. Who wakes up one morning, decides to get engaged, goes out ring shopping, and then sets up a perfect proposal? It's classic Swiss. I absolutely love that ring. Every year, Swiss tries to outdo himself by presenting me with a flashier one. "Will you stop?" I finally told him. "Bling is not my thing. Simplicity in the shape of a heart from the man who captured mine always will be." Soon after our engagement, my birthday rolled around. This one marked the beginning of our birthday wars, the annual attempt to outdo each other in celebration. Some years we go all out, other years we keep it low key, but no less memorable. For this birthday, my 29th, it was an all out year. Swiss took me to Kauai, the Hawaiian island covered in lush tropical rainforests, otherwise known as paradise for a nature lover like me. Around noon on my big day, Swiss said, "Let's go for a drive." We loaded into a two-seater Jeep, curving and winding our way through the forest until we pulled up an hour later at a little house. The home sat on stilts, looking out over the pristine waters of the North Pacific. We climbed the steep stairs, admiring a small garden out front, and then entered the house. There, on a table in the living room, sat an enormous box. "Open it," Swiss said, smiling as he slid the box toward me. I lifted the cardboard flaps and looked inside to see several large canisters. He pulled me close. "I've always wanted you to be my canvas," he whispered. The canisters were full of body paint, in every vibrant color imaginable, and Swiss had had them shipped to the guest house ahead of time. Later, stroke by stroke in the shadows of dusk, he turned me into his masterpiece, covering me in swirls of yellows, reds, and purples. Afterward, my body still tingling from the sensation of cool paint on my warm skin, we walked out to the garden, where he photographed me. Never have I experienced anything more sensual. Which is why, when I missed my period a few weeks later, I wasn't exactly surprised. Swiss was with me when I took the home pregnancy test, but even before it confirmed that I was expecting, we'd both sensed it. The pregnancy wasn't planned, it was inevitable. We were so deeply intertwined on every level, from the soul to the cellular, that even if we hadn't conceived that weekend, it probably would have been a matter of when, not if. As that winter gave way to spring, we relished our two pleasures, the engagement and the pregnancy. In February, I began the Freedom Tour, 43 shows across North America and Europe. Talk about a crazy time to get pregnant. The child I was carrying became my respite, an escape from the whirlwind. After every performance, I'd crawl back into my room feeling exhausted and yet somehow rejuvenated by the presence of this gift growing inside of me. Swiss was my other quiet place. During our moments together between tour stops, I felt at peace inside the intimate bubble we'd built around ourselves. Nothing else seemed to exist or matter when we were with each other. We chose not to reveal the pregnancy or engagement right away. I wanted to carve out a sacred space for my child and myself. And yet keeping my news private came with a trade-off. I didn't get to revel in that outward display of joy that new moms normally experience. Then again, there was nothing normal about my life. Living in tour buses and hotels, on and off for months at a time, I was in such a heavy work cycle just trying to keep up. Even if others had known I was pregnant, there wouldn't have been much opportunity to bask. Only a tiny circle of people initially knew Swiss and I were expecting. My doctor, my mother, Swiss's parents, and Erica. I didn't even tell my road crew and manager for the first several months. My dear friend Wari, who was styling me on tour, might have suspected. In an effort to disguise my developing baby bump, I repeatedly asked him to bring in these long necklaces and loose-fitting tops, but I never told him why. I'm sure he thought I was crazy. Or maybe since we have a friendship dating back to junior high, Wari figured it out and kept quiet. I'm fortunate that I didn't have morning sickness. There was only one night that I almost lost my dinner during a show in Lisbon. I was at the piano, pumping the foot pedals, rocking my medley of creations. Right in the middle of the second verse of Superwoman, a wave of nausea washed over me. I could feel the vomit gathering in my throat. I looked out over the thousands in that stadium and I said to myself, "You will not throw up all over this piano, Alicia." Between the end of that verse and the next, I leaned to my left side, drew in a long breath, closed my eyes, and willed every bit of that vomit back down into my stomach. And then I sat up and kept right on singing. Mercifully, the feeling subsided, because if it hadn't, It would have been one nasty moment. I can just visualize the headlines. Back at the hotel that evening, I told Erica about my close call. As the conversation turned toward what was ahead of me in the coming years, I also admitted the question I'd been carrying around. What if I'm not cut out for motherhood? What if I fail at being responsible for a child, a life? What if I can't do this? There's probably not a parent on earth who hasn't asked those questions in some form at some point in time. I had to be so strong outwardly, but inside, I felt afraid and emotional. The fear was real, and I found so was the whole nesting instinct. I think it's nature's way of prompting a mother to vacuum every corner of her emotional and spiritual house. Even in the earliest months of my pregnancy, I felt a powerful desire to clear my space of all negativity. A similar instinct once carried me to Egypt, but this urge, one on behalf of my baby, was 12 times more forceful. I felt determined to do for my child what I'd once struggled to do for myself. Rid my life of all circumstances that no longer served me. When I told Jeff I was pregnant, he seemed less than thrilled. His response confirmed what my spirit had been whispering for months. We were on two vastly different planets. The old me would have continued anyway, but the woman I was becoming, one with a clear voice and viewpoint, knew a shift had to be made. By the time I told Jeff we needed to transition, we'd been backing away for months. He'd traveled on tour with me less and less, and in fact, we seldom saw each other in person. Ahead of our final conversation, I spent months untangling our legal ties. An artist-manager relationship is similar to a marriage, and ending it can be just as difficult. For 15 years, Jeff had been the point of contact for every aspect of my business, from contracts and collaborations to serving as the primary liaison between me and the record label and the rest of the world. Loosening those massive knots came with a major lesson. In any partnership, whether business or personal, no one individual should hold all the reins. A year earlier, I'd launched my own company, AK Worldwide, with that wisdom in mind. My organization became the command center for every branch of my business. All matters flow in and out of that central office, and all roads lead back to the owner, me. I had never seen myself getting married, maybe because I didn't grow up in a home with marriage at its center. And if two people loved each other, why did they need to sign a legal contract to make that official? In my mind, a government-instituted document could never be the glue that actually held a couple together. Only a day-to-day commitment of the heart could do that. Falling in love with Swiss shifted my perspective a little. "I have an idea," I told Swiss one evening over the phone. "Instead of getting married, what if we just dedicate our lives to each other? We can create our own document stating what kind of relationship we want and sign it ourselves." The line went silent. "What do you mean?" he finally said. "I mean, we're the ones who should define our relationship, right?" I said. "We can even hang our document in the living room to remind us of why we came together. It would be so beautiful and so poetic." For all his bold ideas and out-of-the-box visions, a tiny piece of that man is surprisingly conservative. He didn't want to hear about some hippy-dippy arrangement. He wanted traditional. And though he didn't say that during our call, he did ask a question that melted me. "You don't want to marry me, do you?" "I do," I said. "That's not what I'm trying to say, babe. I just want us to do things our own way." But Swiss thought that was an excuse, my way of wiggling out of a full commitment to him. In the following days, when I noticed him getting down about it, we revisited the conversation and agreed on a compromise. We'd marry the old-fashioned way, but we'd put our own spin on the vows. We finally announced our engagement. We also shared news of the pregnancy when I was about 4 months along, and the public declaration seemed to cause my stomach to pop. We made plans for an intimate ceremony in Corsica, France, near the end of July. A spirit of positivity, that, more than any other detail of my wedding day, was the most important to me. I wanted Swiss and I, as well as our child, to be encircled by good vibrations. That's why we created our guest list so intentionally. We invited loved ones who were truly pulling for us as a couple, those who celebrated and respected our union and would continue to uplift it. 26 people received an invitation, and once their guests were added, the total was less than 50. My brother Bono was there. My dear friend Queen Latifah attended. My girls Erica, Tanisha, and Kat were invited. So were our families, including my mother and father, as well as Swiss's parents and grandparents. Swiss wanted to do something special for me. He decided to go big by asking Deepak Chopra to officiate our ceremony. We both admired his insights, which were in line with the theme of our vows. It turned out that Puff and Deepak lived in the same building, and through Swiss's brotherhood with Puff, Swiss was able to ask Deepak to preside over our nuptials. He graciously agreed. Our friends Alex and Laura offered us their house as a venue. The cliffside home, with its breathtaking view of the Mediterranean, could have been pulled right from the pages of a travel and leisure spread. On the evening before the ceremony, we all gathered for dinner outdoors at a local restaurant. Not long after we were seated at the banquet tables, I felt a sprinkle, then a shower, then a downpour that forced us to scramble indoors with plates in hand, only to return outside later in the evening when the storm had passed. Thankfully, the rain wasn't a sign of weather to come. The morning of our wedding dawned bright and clear. Mom helped me dress. I slid into the one-shoulder Grecian-inspired gown that Vera Wang designed for me, with its ivory silk georgette fabric draped gently over my baby bump. I also wore a headpiece, two strands of intricate jewels that adorned my swept-back hair. Swiss had already made me feel like a goddess. I now glowed like one. A half hour before the ceremony, Craig put his head in the room where I was getting ready. His expression brightened when he glimpsed me. As he started to close the door, Mom said, "Where are you going? We want you to walk Alicia down the aisle with me." Craig teared up. I don't recall how my mother and I made the choice to include him, but it felt right. As complicated as my relationship with Craig has been, he will always be the one man who gave me life. Having him walk me down the aisle was an acknowledgement of that. With Mom on my right arm and Craig on my left, I clutched the bouquet of purple calla lilies. We made our way from the house and onto a steep and winding cobblestone path, and with every step, even in my flats, I prayed I wouldn't fall. I rounded the corner where the guests and groom awaited. Swiss beamed when he saw me. There he stood, so handsome in his tux, so hopeful about the path ahead. He led me onto a platform near a glistening pond. Our exchange of vows was the pinnacle. Face to face, with the world around us seemingly silent, we made our promises. We vowed that full freedom would forever live at the center of our union, that we'd never seek to own each other, but rather to love and liberate, like birds always free to fly. In place of a mandate to be together, there stood a choice, one we'd continue making every single day on our journey. Nearly a decade after we spoke those intentions, we're still holding them, and each other, close. Chapter 13, On Fire.
DJ Walton, president of AK Worldwide and Alicia's longtime friend. I've witnessed Alicia's evolution. Before she had her first son, she was hardcore Hell's Kitchen Alicia. She was as incredibly heartwarming as she is now, and yet she also just didn't play. She got that hustle and drive from her mother, as well as the environment she grew up in. Her work ethic was unsurpassed, constantly touring and promoting on very little sleep, handling a grueling schedule that would have tested even the most dedicated. She took her career so seriously that all of us in her camp had to stay on top of our game. She inspired us to do that because she led by example. Even when she was pregnant, not always feeling her best, she'd go out on stage and kill it. She never missed a show. And after she had Egypt, I saw a dramatic shift in her. She was still hardworking and ambitious, but she went from intense Alicia to kumbaya Alicia, at one with the earth. The change came overnight. She lightened up. She had new priorities. If a gig didn't work out in her schedule, she'd just move on. She was much more relaxed in her approach and much more at peace with herself.
I wanted our baby's gender to be a surprise. For the first few months of my pregnancy, I got my wish. And then I got a sonogram while on the road. You should keep on top of your checkups while you're traveling, my New York doctor told me before I left on the Freedom Tour. Your sonogram results can be sent to me. So around the 5-month mark while I was in London, I made an appointment with an OBGYN I didn't know, this chatty Brit who joked the whole way through the procedure. I lay horizontal as he slowly glided a small sensor across my stomach. He stopped just above my navel, studied the monitor on my right, and grinned. "Looks like your baby has a third leg," he said. It was hysterical. It also blew the lid off a surprise I'd been determined to keep. What's crazy is that I knew it was a boy. On the road, I was in and out of hotels, by myself a lot in the evenings. I employ 50-plus people on a tour, but it can be very lonely. Once the show is over and I'm back in my room, it's just me and my jet lag. In the middle of the night, I'd often feel the baby's spirit, and that spirit was definitely a he, a masculine energy. At certain moments, I felt as if my son were already born and walking alongside me, bringing me comfort and companionship. After our wedding, the countdown to joy intensified. With about 3 months until my delivery, Swiss and I took a baby basics class a friend recommended. A mother's instincts tells her some things about nurturing a newborn, but not everything. Fresh off my course in breastfeeding and swaddling, my OBGYN, this incredible female doctor who'd mastered old-school birthing techniques like delivering a breech baby naturally, turned me on to the Marie Mongin method of hypnobirthing. A way to manage pain using a state of focused attention, aka hypnosis, during natural childbirth. In the weeks leading up to delivery, Swiss and I practiced being relaxed and open, because when you're stressed, you're clenched and closed. We also rehearsed putting Swiss's voice in my head so that when he spoke during the birthing process, his words and vocals would prompt deep calm for me. Hypnobirthing is a next-level, beautiful concept that I found incredibly empowering. For years, I've understood how the words we choose and repeat can frame and define our experience. Hypnobirthing incorporates that principle. When you change your vocabulary around the birthing process, our instructor told us, you alter how you relate to the process. So instead of using the word contraction, which sounds harsh and excruciating, you use the word surge, which accurately describes the rolling vibration, peeking into a wave of discomfort that I felt during my birthing process. I was also taught how to protect the space around the baby and me. As any pregnant woman can tell you, everyone seems to have a labor horror story to share, and I learned to interrupt storytellers mid-sentence. "I'm sorry you experienced that," I'd say, "but I want to keep my thoughts clear and positive." On the morning of October 14, 2010, a surge woke me up at 2 a.m. I didn't recognize the sensation, so I ignored it and drifted back to sleep. When another one hit an hour and a half later, I got up, turned on the light, and waddled over to a rocking chair in our bedroom. "Baby, please wake up and start timing these," I said, recalling my doctor's instructions to keep track of the amount of time between surges and head to the hospital when they were an hour apart. My man sleepily pulled out a pen and paper and wrote down the first time, then he blacked out again. This went on for several hours before I finally insisted that he show me the paper. There, scattered across the sheet, were numbers all over the damn place, some upside down, others crooked, none of the times listed in order. My water hadn't yet broken, but it was time to get moving, as best as I could tell by my inner surge clock. With Swiss at my side and his voice in my ear, I surged my way into motherhood. The doctor placed my miracle right into the warm skin of my chest, my son's heart beating in rhythm with my own. Weeks before he arrived, we'd chosen his name. "The Egypt trip was such a defining moment in your life," Swiss said. "Wouldn't that be amazing as a name?" It felt right the moment I heard it, as did adding in Swiss's middle name, Daoud. 2 days later, I left the hospital cradling Egypt Daoud Dean, my constant reminder of a life-altering pilgrimage that taught me what liberation feels like. Soon after I arrived home, one of my mom's dearest longtime friends, my auntie Elaine, stopped by to see us. After she cuddled Egypt for the first time, she and I sat together in the kitchen. "You got your big girl panties now, don't you?" she said, smiling. It was true in every way. I'd literally gone from wearing tiny thongs to these big cotton drawers, but I'd also stepped squarely into a space that felt at once divine and daunting. This little soul, this child laying swaddled in my arms, was now my responsibility, just as I'd once been my mother's. Becoming a parent involves more than just bathing and feeding and changing. Though there's a lot of that involved, it's also a sacred assignment to teach and love and celebrate. And it is, for Swiss and me, a commitment to raise a boy, a son, a king, a man. When Egypt was 3 months old, I returned to the studio fiercely focused. I took control of my schedule with far greater force than I had upon returning from those 2 weeks of silence in Egypt. For me, motherhood came with a litmus test. Is what I'm doing important enough for me to spend time away from my baby? If the answer was no, the task went the way of the Walkman cassette recorder, phased out. Gone was the era when I'd spend days at a time in a studio, not just burning the candle at both ends, but melting it right down to a messy puddle of wax. Parenting, complete with its 2 a.m. feedings and pumping in the studios to ensure Egypt always had enough milk, pulled me toward a new frequency. I was intent on doing what was best for my child, which, by default, was best for me. I called this new focus "Girl on Fire" energy. The lyrics to that song just tumbled out of me, as if the universe had written it on my behalf. I'd been thinking about the powerful women around me. My mother, my godmother, my sister friends Tanisha and Kat, and the many others I'd crossed paths with over the years. The world can be a challenging place for us women to navigate. We often find ourselves feeling burned out, incapable, and lonely, and yet we're still so resilient. I'd carried that thought around for a couple of weeks when the words flowed out of me while we were in the studio one afternoon. "Hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire. Filled with catastrophe, but she knows she could fly away. Whoa, she got both feet on the ground and she's burning it down." The lyrics perfectly captured what I'd been feeling. The idea that women, even in our vulnerability, continue trudging forward. We still make our moves. We still rise to the moment. Like the words of Superwoman, the message was as much a celebration of others as it was a reminder to me. We wrote the lyrics before putting them to music. I'd brought in two awesome producers for that part, Jeff Basker, a Grammy Award-winning songwriter who also wrote lyrics with me, and Salam Remy, who has worked with artists like Amy Winehouse and Nas. I slipped out of the studio session for a restroom break and I just had to call Swiss. The sound of the chorus thundered through the walls as I dialed my husband.
This girl is on fire!
Babe, something crazy is happening here, I told Swiss when he picked up. Seriously? Yes, I told him, and I don't know how to explain it. You've got to hear it. It might be rare that an artist can predict what will resonate, like with Empire, but that song right there, I knew Girl on Fire would hit. I felt it in every fiber of my being. During the creative process, I never know how a song is going to come to me, but every now and then, the universe sends me a gift. The lyrics and melodies seemingly just appear, and I'm grateful whenever that happens. By this time, I'd relocated my studio. Ann Mencielli, my sound engineer, business partner, and friend, approached me with the idea. Ann and I go way back. In 1997, she and I met at Quad Studios in Times Square. She was an assistant sound engineer then, and I was a newly signed artist, mostly still doing vocals in the closet of Kerry's Harlem apartment. In many ways, Ann and I have grown up together in the industry. We vibe because we're both sky's the beginning visionaries. In 2010, Ann purchased 2 commercial condos in Chelsea. She transformed the space into Jungle City Studios, a state-of-the-art, 7-star artist haven offering the best in vintage and modern technology. When Swiss and I returned from our honeymoon in Saint-Tropez, Ann told me about the project and showed me the space. I was blown away. What do you think about moving your studio here? She asked. I loved the idea. On the building's east side, Jungle City provides space for the thriving community of musicians who regularly book there. On the building's west side, I purchased the 2 condos mirroring Jungle City and moved my oven studios from Long Island to the new space. It has since become my personal playground, one that allows me to create on my own terms. No one can ever tell me when, whether, or how to make music because I own the place. What a long road from walls soundproofed with comforters to a top-of-the-line studio. This new space next to Jungle City was where I recorded much of Girl on Fire. Making the album was like throwing a big house party, one filled with the dopest guests. The collaborations abounded, from Maxwell's sultry contributions on the slow jam Fire remake and Bruno Mars writing and background vocals on Tears Always Win to the Babyface collaboration That's When I Knew. In 2011, I took my party to Jamaica and turned it into a writing camp at G-Jam Studios in Port Antonio. John Legend, Miguel, and Babyface flew in. These 2 awesome producers and writers, Pop and Oak, came, as did producers and writers Antonio Dixon, Stacey Barth, and Jamie Smith of the XX. Rodney Jerkins, the hitmaker for artists like Michael Jackson and Lady Gaga, joined us. Our time in Bob Marley's homeland turned into a whole series of circulating sessions. It was sick. The renowned British artist and singer-songwriter Emily Sandy partnered with me on several of the album's songs, including one of my favorites, Not Even the King. The lyrics tell of a ruler who lives in a castle surrounded by people, but who has not a single friend who isn't on the payroll. He has wealth and power, but is missing what's priceless, real relationships. I wrote that song after watching a couple I know, 2 great-hearted people, walk through a soul-wrenching time. From a financial standpoint, they were set. Mansions, cars, vacation homes. And yet despite their enormous wealth, they were experiencing deep emptiness, a condition no amount of money could cure. As I watched my friend struggle, I thought, if striving for billions comes with that kind of emptiness, then I'm straight. The point isn't that wealth should be feared or disregarded. My family is successful and we plan to build on that. But as we move in that direction, I work to stay mindful of what I most value. For me, it comes down to capacity. What kind of life do I want to build? And what sacrifices will that require? What commitments can I let go of so I can remain a conscious partner and parent? What works for me is extreme weed pulling on my to-do list. Clearing out the unnecessary creates the space and conditions for me to nurture my connection with family. and the soil beneath it all is acceptance. I do everything I can to be a present mother and partner, and then daily I make peace with what has had to go undone. It's all any of us can ask of ourselves. Brand New Me, another song I did with Emily, reflects the zone I was in while making the album, and the lyrics showcase that.
It's been a while. I'm not who I was before. You look surprised. Your words don't burn me anymore. Been meaning to tell ya, but I guess it's clear to see. Don't be mad. It's just a brand new kind of me. Can't be bad. I found a brand new kind of free.
In fact, when you look at many of the titles, like Girl on Fire, New Day, and That's When I Knew, a song inspired by my relationship with Swiss, the theme is as obvious on this page as it was in my life. My senses were sharp, my energy sparkling. I was open, a wide clearing for the songs to come through me. I was a channel of free expression. On the magic carpet ride of my life, I've shared the stage with some of music's greatest icons. One highlight being the incomparable Stevie Wonder. During the months when I was completing Girl on Fire and feeling bathed in that energy, Stevie and I performed at the 2012 Billboard Awards. Our duet included Higher Ground and Overjoyed, which sums up the immeasurable excitement I felt during the experience. At the close of the show, Stevie, who'd recently celebrated his 62nd birthday, made a request. "I want you to give me a birthday gift," he said. "I want you to sing Empire State a cappella." Still high on the energy of our duet, I pecked around on the keyboard to find my opening note. "Will y'all help me?" I yelled into the mic. The crowd applauded. I cleared my throat, reached down into a far corner of my diaphragm, and pulled out the first line of the chorus.
In New York, concrete jungle where dreams are made of.
Stevie swayed and clapped. "Happy birthday," I said to the man who in 1981 gave the world the most soulful version of that song. This wasn't my first time singing with the Grammy Award-winning legend, nor my second. Before our group jam session at President Obama's 2009 inaugural ball, I performed with Stevie and Lenny Kravitz at MTV's 2004 Video Music Awards. Ahead of the show, the three of us planned to rehearse at Lenny's studio in Miami. I arrived before Stevie did, and Lenny warmly greeted me at the door. "Come on in," he said. Everything about Lenny, his style, his artistry, his swag, the spaces he curates, exudes badassery. That man is the epitome of cool. And his studio was as eclectically fascinating as you'd expect, starting with, in his entryway, a massive mural done by Jonah Sierwinski, the artist known for creating elaborate images using only the stroke of a black Sharpie. As we awaited Stevie's arrival, Lenny and I began practicing our parts for Higher Ground. An assistant popped her head in our door a few minutes later. "Mr. Wonder will be here in 20 minutes," she said. Right then, one of my singers, Whitney, who'd been rehearsing with us, stepped out for what I thought was a quick run to the ladies' room. When she returned 15 minutes later, she was completely dolled up in a dress and heels. You know Stevie won't be able to see you," I joked. "Yes," Whitney said, "but he'll be able to feel if I'm not right." We cracked up. I don't know whether Stevie could sense her appearance, but I do know one thing. Her energy was on point for the rest of the session. Stevie arrived with that trademark grin on his face and a harmonica in his pocket. I tried to disguise the tremor in my voice as we warmed up. There I sat at my keyboard, playing and singing alongside one of the world's most creative geniuses, the artist behind an immense catalog that extends through more than a half century. Decades before my existence was even the tiniest seed of a thought, little Stevie, who was just 11 when Berry Gordy signed him to Motown back in 1961, was already captivating the world with his hits like Fingertips and Uptight, Everything's All Right. That was only the beginning, with amazing songs like As and Boogie on Reggae Woman, and the song that will forever give me goosebumps, They Won't Go When I Go, from Fulfillingness First Finale. Stevie's creations serve as a backdrop for our lives, both marking time and reflecting it. And for me, he is an example of what a true musician should be, a boundary pusher who values artistic growth, at times even more than commercial success. So on the afternoon when Lenny and I jammed with Stevie for several hours straight, my body was there, but my head was someplace else. It was even more surreal when, in addition to our Higher Ground performance, Stevie pulled out his harmonica and played along as I sang If I Ain't Got You. It was one of the greatest pinch me moments of my life, right up there with meeting Prince, the other artist who has had a profound impact on my artistry. Both Stevie and Prince have provided me with a powerful blueprint of what creating outside of the lines looks like. Prince and I stayed connected long after that day in 2001 when I had nervously awaited the sound of his voice over the phone. And with every encounter after that, I was no less tongue-tied. During my Songs in A Minor tour, Prince came to one of my shows. He took a spot near the soundboard, the place in a theater where the sound quality is usually the best. I heard Prince might be there that evening, which made me nervous. Afterward, he met me backstage. "Good show," he said, "but I didn't like the sound." I stared blankly at him, not sure how to respond. "You don't like the sound?" I finally said. "The balance is not good," he explained. I didn't love hearing that, especially from someone I held in such high regard, but I also received the critique as he'd intended it, as a teaching moment. Also, I knew he was right. The engineering had thrown off the sonic. Ultimately, the feedback let me do some fine tuning to elevate my production quality. Better. That is what Prince and all others who achieve excellence are always pushing toward. They rise. They insist upon meticulousness. And in so doing, they alter the very space they inhabit. In 2004, when Prince offered me the great honor of inducting him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I spoke of that idea. "There are many kings," I said as I stood at the podium. "King Henry VIII, King Solomon, King Tut, King James, King Kong, the three kings. But there is only one prince, only one man who has defied restriction." No matter where in the world I was, Prince always knew how to get in touch with me. I might not see or talk to him for months, and then boom, someone on his team would dial me up. "Prince would like to talk with you," I'd hear. Many times he'd just call to encourage me. After he heard You Don't Know My Name, he told me, "I really love that new song." I can still feel the electricity surging through me. Years later, he came to another one of my shows, and by then, I was playing in big 7,000-seat arenas. "Your audience doesn't look the same anymore," he told me backstage after the show. I just stood there. I never quite knew what to say to Prince. "That happened with me," he went on. "Over time, my audience became much more diverse." I'm sure he could see the question splashed across my face. "Isn't that good?" To this day, I am amazed at the diversity of my audiences. How 67-year-old white men come to concerts with their 15-year-old grandkids. Prince didn't offer a conclusion that day. He was just pointing out the similarity. In the following years, Prince and I talked more about the natural shifts that come with evolving as an artist. I didn't always understand what he meant at the time, but I do now. When you put out your first album, you strike a chord with a certain group of people. That chord is so genuine that the group rallies around you. Your music both speaks to and reflects them. Their applause becomes the water for your growth. you feel free to expand and experiment with new sounds, and the resulting music widens your audience to include new groups that hadn't paid you much attention in the beginning. There may come a moment when your original crew doesn't like your new direction. Prince masterfully pulled off a juggling feat that some musicians find impossible. He continually widened his audience and his artistry without ever alienating his core group. That is my own intention. I want to super serve my most committed tribe, those like-minded listeners who've been with me from the start, even as I push myself artistically and expand my fam. This is one of the great lessons Prince passed on to me. His legacy, like Stevie's, has lifted me and countless others onto higher ground. Becoming a mother opens a new wing in your heart. You think you've always known how to love, and you have, but it's only after your child arrives that your love takes on new shades and textures you hadn't even known existed. Your capacity for care expands. It's a love not based on reciprocity or conditions, but on existence alone. You care for your child simply because he or she is yours, and that love can't help but spill over into other spaces in your life. It's a revival of the senses, one that can be heard in every measure of the Girl on Fire album. Girl on Fire, the lead single, blazed a path around the globe and back again. The song is still one of the biggest records in my catalog. It crossed over in every way, with millennials and boomers, gay and straight, soccer moms and urban hipsters, schoolgirls in Africa, and grandmothers in Dubai. It became the definition of viral. My youngest son would one day, at age 4, be able to recite every single word of Girl on Fire. There's just something about that song that resonates. That probably has a lot to do with the catchy and memorable chorus. And the image on the album's cover, I call that my hell yeah pose. What a drastic difference energetically between that photo and the one on Element. I stand with my hands on my hips and my eyes on the truth, unflinching in my gaze and courageous in my resolve. I'm no longer on simmer, relegated to life's back burner, pushing everything and everyone out front in place of me. I am radiant and determined, wild and untamable, and at long last, woke. Part 3, Awakening. Just wondering, when will we fly above the mess, the confusion, the hatred, the lies that untie us? Just wondering. When will we see each other as golden, and children as innocent, meant to be protected, and color as irrelevant, and love as everything? Just wondering. 'Cause I know we are more than the tragedy, but every day there's another, to the left and right of me, with unanswered questions and unaccountability. When I look at us, I see what we could be, free from the mess and slumbering. But I'm just wondering, when will we fly above the past, those things we were taught, the confusion, the hatred, the lies that untie us? Just wondering, when will we see each other as golden, and children as innocent, meant to be protected, and color as irrelevant, and love as everything? Just wondering. Chapter 14, New Vision. Before I begin, let me share a message with you from my friend, Vano.
It's not every day you have lunch with the President of the United States in his private dining room, in the White House. It was just the three of us, myself, Alicia, and President Obama. There was a guitar in the corner, a guitar I had given to him. I picked it up and for a laugh began playing and singing Norwegian Wood. a Beatles song. Alicia sung along for a few bars, and just by way of winding up the president, ragging him, I asked, "You and Michelle ever do some karaoke then?" "Michelle does," he says. "I mean, not here in the White House, but at Camp David. And actually, Michelle is pretty good on karaoke." "And what about you?" I asked. "Oh," he says mischievously, "I don't do karaoke." "How come you don't do karaoke?" Alicia says. "Is it beneath you, Mr. President?" "Oh, no," he said. "I don't do karaoke because I can actually sing." "Prove it," I said. Then, in this perfect baritone, he begins singing a Bill Withers song. "Just the Two of Us" or something. Alicia looks at me. I look at him. And we're like, "Come on, dude. It's not enough to be the leader of the free world and have a wife like Michelle. You can sing." Anyway, he has this big, big smile on his face. At the end of the lunch, as we walked out, I said to Alicia, "Look, you and I should never tell this story, because if we do, people are going to ask him to sing again and again." She said, "Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's keep this one to ourselves." Not long after, without us saying a word, the president seemed to be singing everywhere. It was like he'd woken up to that side of himself. The man was everywhere singing.
The White House hums majesty and whispers glory. Beneath the crystal chandelier of the yellow oval room, along the West Wing colonnade walked by world leaders, history and grandeur intersect. Lincoln once resided in these walls. JFK Jr. played under his father's Oval Office desk. President Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act into law. And following that November day in 2008, when the people spoke, President and Mrs. Obama began the transition out of their Chicago home and into America's storyline. During the Obamas' 8 years in the White House, I had the privilege of visiting more than once, and each time I grew to respect the first family more and more. One of my first visits came in March 2009, only 2 short months after the inauguration, yet long enough for Mrs. Obama to begin lifting girls into the spotlight. In celebration of Women's History Month, the First Lady brought together 21 female trailblazers like astronaut Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman in space, and Olympic gymnast Dominique Dawes. She also gathered artists such as Kerry Washington, Sheryl Crow, Tracy Ellis Ross, and Felicia Rashad. I was honored to be among the group. The plan was straightforward. We'd first gather in the diplomatic reception room near the front of the White House, before dispersing to share our stories with girls in several D.C. area schools. We'd then return that evening for a celebratory East Room dinner with some of the students. "Our job is simple," Mrs. Obama said to us before we set out. "Just be open, be honest, be real, be clear, and have fun." In essence, she was asking us to be who she'd already been for us, 1,000,000% authentic. That morning when I'd arrived at the White House, Mrs. Obama, the perfect combination of a refined first lady and your coolest, most down-to-earth sister, immediately put me at ease with a warm embrace and welcome. Even in such a lavish setting, she somehow made me feel like I could drop my shoulders. I'd met Mrs. Obama before. In May 2005, I visited Oprah's home, an awe-inspiring estate tucked between the hills of Santa Barbara and the Pacific. If heaven has a representation here on Earth, it might just be the Promised Land, the nickname for Oprah's Montecito home. Down the cobblestone pathway known as Hallelujah Lane, a dozen mighty oaks, the 12 apostles, as Oprah calls them, raised their arms in sweet surrender. Just beyond a fountain, her Neo-Georgian house sits atop a hill, with its head held high. It was in that magic kingdom that Oprah hosted Legends Weekend, a monumental 3-day celebration of 25 extraordinary African-American women whose talent and tenacity have built a bridge from past to present. Oprah also invited 45 youngins, those who, like me, have crossed over on that bridge. Everyone from Mariah Carey, Mary J. Blige, and Naomi Campbell to Halle Berry, Natalie Cole, and Angela Bassett. Joy lit up each face and love lived in every detail. In the words of the youngins, collectively reading to the legends, "We Speak Your Names," a poem penned by Pearl Cleage, the glamorous white tie gala, and a heart-opening brunch during which B.B. Winans handed the mic to Shirley Caesar, the mother of gospel, and the spirit took it from there. The whole experience was transcendent, like waking up in paradise and meeting every person I'd ever dreamed of meeting. Coretta Scott King, Diana Ross, and Maya Angelou were on my right. Tina Turner, Chaka Khan, and Roberta Flack were on my left. The phenomenal Cicely Tyson, glowing and regal, sat near me on the couch. At one point, I was so overwhelmed that I took a seat on the staircase in the living room and cried. "Can I please have some paper?" I asked Oprah. Moments later, she handed me a journal, and I poured my feelings onto the page in a stream of consciousness torrent. That's how moved I was, and how humbled I felt to be surrounded by such greatness. It made me want to uphold that legacy of greatness, both in the world and in my artistry. Later, when Mrs. Obama arrived at the gala, Oprah leaned in and said to me, "That's Michelle. Her husband, Barack, might one day be the first Black president." 3 years later, history indeed leaned in that direction, guiding the Obamas to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. After the full body chills of those experiences came another thrill. Bono and I were invited to lunch with President Obama in 2011. Upon arrival, we were escorted right into the Oval Office. The president stood from behind his desk and walked over to greet us. "Come on in," he said. He showed us into a small room adjacent to the Oval Office. "Where should we sit?" asked Bono. "Sit wherever there's a chair," said the president, laughing. That's when Bono spotted a guitar in the corner, a campaign memento from a Rock the Vote event. He picked it up and began playing and singing the second verse of Norwegian Wood. She asked me to stay, and she told me to sit anywhere, so I looked around and noticed there wasn't a chair. All of this, for me, was happening in slow motion through the hazy filter of surrealism. On the agenda, the importance of worldwide HIV and AIDS funding. In the previous administration, Bono and I had worked to ensure that President Bush kept America's funding in place. With President Obama, we again stressed the need for our country to stay on the front lines of the pandemic. I talked about what I'd learned in my work with Keep a Child Alive, and yet the lunch felt less like a business meeting and more like a family dinner. During 3 courses over a full hour, laughter flowed as we shared what was happening in our personal lives. Between the first sip of soup and the last spoonful of berries, I took it all in, wanting to imprint in my memory every story, every expression, every feeling of the day. Even in my dazed, "I can't believe I'm here" state, I'd never been more present. For me, this lunch represented the gift that I and every other artist has been given. Our creations have the ability to reach people from all worlds, from those on 125th Street in Harlem to those serving our nation in the Capitol. Music is a powerful uniter. An artist's life is a teeter-totter. When you're in the lowered position, you're composing at the piano, you're in the studio, you're breathing sounds and beats and lyrics. Then, when your side of the board goes up, the energy suddenly shifts. You're on tour, performing for thousands most nights. Your focus moves from inward to outward. Between each 6-week leg of a tour, There's usually a couple of weeks off, but even then, you're in constant motion, trying to catch up on everything. Then later, when the tour circuit finally ends, boom, you're back in the studio for the next round of creating. You're also back in your kitchen, trying to remember where your pots and pans are. That is the general rhythm of my existence. Up, down, up, down. And the whole time I'm teetering, I'm also holding my family tight. Swiss and I are striving to keep our promise never to go more than 2 weeks without seeing each other. And yes, we actually keep that vow. Swiss has even flown from New York to Sydney to be with me, in order to keep that commitment intact. FaceTime and always planning sweet things for each other is what keeps our connection fresh. Our schedules are so hectic that if we weren't intentional, we could easily schedule each other out of our lives. He's on business in Shanghai or London while I'm racing through 50 cities during a tour leg. We also set aside 1 week in a month to go away together, just the two of us, even if the getaway is only a 30-minute drive to a cozy hotel in Lower Manhattan. We'll check in on a Saturday afternoon, go explore an exhibit, and head someplace nice for dinner that evening, and then sleep in on Sunday morning. I bring my village of support on tour with me, and I'm super deliberate about surrounding my children with family. My son Egypt has often been with me on the road, spending as much time as possible with me, even as his two grandmothers travel in to lend a hand. I'm insistent that I do most of the caretaking. My albums and tours, as well as the breaks in between them for concentrated family time and other business endeavors, are how I remember the seasons. The seesaw is how I mark time. After the Girl on Fire album hit around Thanksgiving in 2012, the usual flurry of press appearances came with it. I'd agreed to do a photo shoot and interview for a magazine cover story. Just as the issue was hitting newsstands, I saw the cover. I stared at the image, which was a shot of me from the waist up. Whose arms are those? I thought, pulling the page closer to study it. My arms and shoulders had been majorly airbrushed to seem smaller than they are. In fact, it was so overdone that it looked like my head had been pasted onto someone else's body. It stung. It felt like someone's judgment of me had been delivered in secret from behind a computer screen. We live in a culture where there's seldom space for imperfection, for celebrating our perfectly imperfect bodies. In this case, someone had decided, at his or her own discretion and without consulting me, that a part of my body that I like was, in their view, a flaw, one unfit for public display. I wish I could tell you that incident was isolated, but that kind of thing happens all the time. Just as it had years earlier during that hypersexual photo shoot I felt manipulated into doing. Even when you conduct a shoot on your own terms, someone else chooses how you'll be portrayed. More time would have to pass before I realized how our society's oppressive standard of female beauty had left deep claw marks in me. It's hard not to begin doubting yourself just a little when, with the stroke of an airbrush, someone slims down your thighs or shaves off half your booty. And if I'm doubting myself, imagine what that does for the young people forced to digest these images of so-called beauty. It was this fake arms cover that led me to begin taking the stance I take now. I need to approve photographers' images of me ahead of publication. In fact, I'm unrelenting about it. I'm supposed to own my body and its presentation. That I know for sure. The Set the World on Fire tour began in March 2013. The tour was then my most extensive ever, sweeping through Australia and Asia and the Middle East, as well as through the major capitals in Europe and North and South America. Once home at the start of 2014, the seesaw tipped and I got back in songwriting mode. I began with a list. On the plane ride back from the tour, Erica and I feverishly wrote down everything we were sick of, like how girls are so often sexually victimized, how boys are raised to believe that being hard and playing with guns make you a real man, how wars are fought more for money than for the good of humanity, how women are evaluated above all else for their appearance, how people of color are frequently targets of police brutality. With every observation and headline, like the 2012 death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, escalating hate crimes, mass shootings seemingly every month, I'd become more and more disturbed. The list became my guide in creating my next album, Here. This wasn't going to be some fleeting or frivolous project. Every issue was one that had grieved me, dissatisfied me, and stirred me up over the years. That's one reason I brought together a small group of collaborators, all whom shared my intention to deeply impact the culture, to create a cohesive message and sound. I teamed up with two top-level writers I'd known and worked with over many years, Harold Lilly, who composed with me on You Don't Know My Name and Unbreakable, and Mark Batson, who contributed on As I Am. Others would have input, but that remained the core group. I called us the Illuminaries, artists committed to spreading light, and also because we're ill, as in amazing. Swiss eventually joined our production and writing team, marking our first full project together. From the start, it